Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, imagine you could call up a friend and say, meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy. Now, imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now, stop imagining and subscribe to the Planet Money podcast. Find Planet Money on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll talk about a new television take on a chilly but wonderful film and about what happens when you adapt something great and try to make something else great. We'll delve into something we're calling pop culture breadcrumbs, and as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Bob Mondello, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movie critic for All Things Considered.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Now, before we get into the meat of today's show, we did want to cover a piece of personal business to those of us here on the show. Many of you have been asking about the fact that our pal Trey Graham has been not on the show the last couple of weeks, and we did want to give you an update, which is that Trey decided recently to move on from NPR, and that means move on from us. But he left for all of you a message, which he suggested, and I thought this was rather brilliant, that his message could be read for you by Glenn Weldon, because many of you cannot tell the difference between them anyway. So he thought, you know, voice twin-wise, it would be good. So Glenn, why don't you take it away with our letter from Trey?
Sure, okay. He says, hey, everybody, when you hear this, there's a good possibility I'm going to be on a beach. It's been a great ride with NPR and with you, the PCHH gang in particular. This is a project that grew out of real friendships, and that's always been a huge part of what makes it work. So I want to thank Glenn, Linda, and Stephen for being amazing always and for being the funniest people I know. I'm off to see my nephews. Then I'm off on a train trip that will involve checking on theater and theater people across the country. Trains and theater, two of my favorite things, so I'm really looking forward to it. And now, just to complete the Trey Graham trifecta, I wanted to sign off by saying that I'm listening to German art song as I type this. It's called Im Abendrot, and it's about being happy when something comes to an end after a good long run. See you all around. TG.
Very nice.
A class act, that guy.
A class act, that guy, for sure. And, you know, we would have loved to have him here to read that himself.
Yep.
It is one of those things, the timing of the way that these things come up and that you tape and all that. We did not get a chance to do it. But
I actually found it was really difficult to lock Trey in the studio while having him not in the building.
Yeah, it's true. And he was pretty eager, I think, to get on all this train and theater and nephew business.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is just a convenient fiction. We can actually tell the people what's actually happened, which is that Trey and I belong to a race of immortals who must battle constantly a time that we call the gathering. He is the Sean Connery to my Christopher Lambert, and there can be only one middle-aged gay dude on an NPR podcast.
Wait, what about me?
Watch your back, my dog.
Bob, this is Glenn's way of saying that you're an old man.
Apparently. So, I'm beyond middle age.
So, yeah, I smote him, and smote him with my katana and took his quickening. I do want to say, seriously, that, you know, I wouldn't have a professional writing career if it wasn't for Trey Graham. I mean, I was writing and getting paid in contributors' copies of literary magazines.
Uh-huh.
And I was, at the time, I was writing some stuff, actually, on what we talked about last week, the Television Without Pity forums, some dumb jokes about a couple of shows called Boy Meets Boy and Playing It Straight. Two very terrible shows.
I watched Playing It Straight.
The fact that those posts are lost to the world just pains me so much.
And he saw them and said, you should write, at the time, he wanted me to write for the Washington City paper, mm-hmm. where he was freelancing, and I put him off. I said, look, I have these airless, smug short stories filled with characters that nobody cares about, to whom nothing happens, and I really got to see where these go.
Why would you ever want to do anything else? Exactly.
But eventually I relented, and because he kept after me, like a good guy, and that led to freelancing a bunch of places, including City Paper and NPR, which led to the Superman book, which led to the Batman book, so I owe that guy a lot. I love him like a brother, and I wish him all the best. He's not dead. He's still tweeting.
Right, it's true.
He
still asked Trey with an E and Graham like the cracker.
Absolutely. And just this weekend, it's not a bit, he actually was tweeting about German art song.
He was. It's true.
There's no recovering
it's That's true. It's true. And I would add, along similar lines, you know, when I first came to NPR, Trey was my primary work ally. And as I told him several times, not only helped me get hired and helped me figure out how to do the blog, but talked me off of many, many ledges
Oh, my God. I owe that guy such a solid. he took so many for the team.
So you can tell from Stephen's sense of relief that Stephen knows that indeed Trey kept me from having various nervous breakdowns. And I would not have, you know, I would not have survived the experience in the early going otherwise. And also, you know, later, he took me to the Kennedy Center. He took me to see Next to Normal, and sure. He took me to see Follies, and it was wonderful. And we love him, and we will miss him very much. And you know, and we wish him obviously all the best.
Yeah, one of the first things that I said about Trey to Linda, and you talk about whether this show would exist without various people. The first thing that I said to Linda about Trey was, he's a natural ally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what he was throughout his time here. He is still alive. I'm talking about him as if he has
We're
died.
We're just saying.
He's still our pal.
Right, exactly.
Not only is he still alive, he is still our pal.
And I have to say, I know of no writer who is more gorgeous when he writes. I mean, I love reading him in City Paper. I love reading him on
I thought
website.
You meant like him sitting at a computer. He's just so regal.
No, just, well there is that. There is something regal about his
carriage. There is.
But he's an astonishing writer. He really is. I've been friends with him for years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
And he's, I think I actually brought him here. I won't swear to that.
Yeah,
but
he's.
So you're one of the people that this show owes its existence to.
There, see?
That's right. Another one. Yeah, and I mean, you know, Trey, when I first started doing the blog, Trey was my editor and did a lot more editing before he got more busy and didn't have as much time to edit everything. But I used to tell people, you know, everything that I write is better after Trey edits it. And I would have him edit my shopping list if I had the opportunity because
he did have a great...
I was going to say, you'd probably spend more on groceries.
It's, it's true. But he did have a lovely touch with writing. And we speak in the past tense only because we want to sort of honor all this great work, not because, as we have pointed out, he's not dead.
He ain't dead.
And I think you'll hear more, you know, from
him.
He's going to do other cool things, as he mentioned, this theater trip and train stuff. And
yeah, and he said on his Facebook page that he's off to chase new rainbows, which, let's just stipulate, is the Trey Grammiest of mic drops. It's possible to imagine.
It's really true. It's really true. And we are doing our best to sort of silver lining this for ourselves. Yeah. And just so you are all aware, there's no new Trey. You know, there's no new opera guy. There's no new opera and theater guy. We're not casting a new guy who cares about RuPaul and Shakespeare. We're not putting out that announcement. As you know, if you listen to the show, we have had this wonderful variety of people who we really love who have come in to do the show, like Bob and like Jean and Kat and Matt and Tanya. And our plan right now is to just use lots and lots of those great people and some new people who we intend to have on the show. So there's no new nifty theater guy that's going to come in and be like, now I'm the theater guy. Because there's no new Trey.
Nope.
You don't go out and just get another Trey. Trays don't grow on trees. You know.
Do not.
So that is our news. And we hope that all of you will join us in wishing him well and good wishes for on to the next thing.
Yeah, we should actually start a thread on our Facebook page specifically for tributes to our man, Trey Graham.
Absolutely. Absolutely, I think.
And they can focus on the fact that he is still alive.
Absolutely. He is. This is the point where, you know, you have the black and white photo of his face and under it it says Trey Graham and someone is like singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Yeah. Anyway, we love you, buddy. And happy rainbows and happy train travel and happy trails in general. Uh-huh. So our first actual topic of discussion today, we are once again, as we were with Captain America, we're a little farther ahead in the time frame, because as you listen to this podcast, you have not seen this yet, but FX is about to unveil on Tuesday,
the 15th,
Fargo, their 10-part limited series adaptation of the Coen brothers' movie of the same name from 1996. Fargo the movie is about a kind of goofball and yet also sort of evil and immoral man played by William H. Macy who has a plot to have his wife kidnapped. And he gets a couple of criminals to do it for him and runs into this lady cop and played by Frances McDormand. And in the TV show, you have an insurance salesman who meets a very scary dude played by Billy Bob Thornton, who kind of wants to talk to him about the way that he accepts and receives abuse from bullies and his not very nice wife. And he has a brother he's competitive with. So there are some parallels, but they are different stories. And it stars Martin Freeman, who you may know as, who you may know as John Krasinski from The British Office.
Right.
Or who you may know from a little Hobbit movie. Mm. Or who you may know from a little Sherlock show.
Sure.
Or some other fantastic things. He is in it playing a Minnesotan gentleman. There are some other people in it. Adam Goldberg is in it. Colin Hanks is in it. The story of the Fargo TV show, to be clear, is kind of tonally similar to, but is not the same story as the story that was in the movie. And I think early on, when people saw the clips of Martin Freeman and there is a woman cop and things like that, they started to kind of say, okay, so this is, you know, Martin Freeman is playing the William H. Macy character and this woman is playing Marge. And it's not that. It is a different story.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons why we wanted to invite Bob is that I know that Bob is a fan of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So talk to me a little bit, Bob, about your fondness for the film.
Well, my, as you know, when you first said this to me, my initial reaction was, but, why are they doing this? Because
right.
the movie is sort of perfect. I was reading some old reviews of it the other day. Roger Ebert said this is the kind of movie that makes him love movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a perfectly fair reaction to it. It is a Coen Brothers movie that is very elegant in being kind of having a tone about an area that you don't think you know at all, but by the end of the picture, you feel as if you know it better than you know your own life. And with characters who are so specific that they become, I don't know, iconic is the wrong word because Marge is not an icon
sure.
of anything, but they overwhelm your impulse to try and make it something extended.
Mm-hmm.
So that what my initial reaction to the whole idea of doing this as a television show was, well, it's going to have to turn on plot then, and I don't care about the plot. I care about these people, these
yeah.
specific people.
Right. And so without these specific characters, without right. Marge and these, especially without her, I think,
yeah.
there's kind of a what's the pointy kind
right.
of feeling to it. What did you think about it when you started watching it?
Well, when I started watching it, I thought I was absolutely right.
That right.
This was a major problem with it and that, oh my God, I don't care about these people. And then something happened about 45 minutes
yeah.
into the first episode.
yeah.
And I went, oh.
I had a very similar experience because I was sent the first four episodes.
Mm.
When we have, I think, all seen the first four.
Yes.
Yep.
I watched about the first half an hour of the first episode mm-hmm. and then got interrupted. And I think when I spoke to Bob about it, Bob said, is it any good? And I said, it's okay. You know,
yeah.
I said, it's, mm-hmm. I don't know. But there is in sort of the back half of that first episode is really where you see what their game is
right.
and where you see where they're going. And then they continue to introduce more characters in the second episode who I liked. I like Colin Hanks in it. I especially like Adam Goldberg in
yep.
it. I think it's a really interesting use of Adam Goldberg, who is in Saving Private Ryan and was Chandler's creepy roommate on Friends and has done all kinds of cool and great stuff. And I think this may prove to be kind of his great moment. Stephen, what did you think?
Yeah, I had a little bit of the same reaction that you guys did, where for about the first half hour, I'm just sitting there. Now, part of it is I deliberately stayed somewhat in the dark on this. I'm like, I'm just going to start it cold. And then I was like, this is not the story. What is...
Right.
And I had to go back and do a little bit of reading on it just to contextualize it. There is, like you said, about a half an hour in, it suddenly clicks into place. And one of the things that happens about a half an hour in is they bring in Bob Odenkirk
mm-hmm.
as a very dumb cop,
mm-hmm.
or at least so far a very dumb mm-hmm. cop. And part of it is because Odenkirk is from Chicago, you know, he has a terrific accent.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people had happen with the original Fargo movie, the accents take a little bit of getting used to.
You betcha. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Ufta. And
there's a lot of ufta in
yeah.
the more than I heard when I actually lived in Minnesota.
Oh,
I mean,
see, I grew up in Iola. I grew up in Iola, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I went to Iola Scandinavia High School
right.
to give you a sense of
did you
how...
hear a lot of unironic ufta?
Yes.
Wow, that's really cool.
Absolutely,
I totally
absolutely. And you would see like the teachers in my school had little wood carvings that spelled ufta. I volunteered at the Lutefisk Supper. I'm telling you.
Yep.
You may have had a more Minnesotan childhood in Wisconsin than I had in Minnesota.
Well, the states, they do interlock.
But ours is better.
Okay, here we go. Wow. Okay, wow. I'm sorry. I'm just going to stop you right there. I'm going to let you finish. But I think that the accents in this are a little wobblier than the accents in Fargo, which are really pretty pitch perfect. And I lived in Wisconsin, obviously, when the original Fargo came out. And you would hear people be like, I don't know about these accents. Why do they think we talk like this? I don't know. You know, oh, gosh. And, you know, I found the accents in Fargo, being someone who lived in Wisconsin but was not actually born there, I found those accents to be pretty spot on.
Yeah.
Here they're a little wobblier, in part because one of the main accents you hear very early in the show is the attempt at that accent by Martin Freeman, who really, at first especially, seems very much to be doing his best William H. Macy.
He seems a little lost at first, accent-wise.
He does, and I think as he becomes more the cilantro in that dish, rather than the entire show seeming to be about him, the show just gets richer and richer and richer.
Yeah. Right. I'll just echo what you've already said, because in the first half hour of watching this, I thought they have taken the wrong lessons. They think they know what made Fargo great, the movie, and they don't, because there are issues of focus, who we're focusing on, but there's also an issue of tone, because one of the things that made Bill Macy's performance in Fargo so great is, yes, he's hapless, yes, he's feckless, he's got no hap, got no feck, but he's also culpable, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
He's greedy, and that greed drives him to make choices, and it seems in the
first half
which
he's already made by the time the movie starts.
Right. And it seems like the producers of this show were stacking the deck so that the thing that sets him off down the road was justifiable.
Right.
They made us feel like, oh, you know, I would have done the same thing in his place. And that's not interesting.
Right.
Because that's what the mistake a lot of dark comedies make, mm-hmm. black comedies make, is they take the moral equation out of it. They think that we, as the audience members, will have that moral, you know, focus.
Right.
So the characters can get away with being transgressive. And it's much more interesting to watch your characters struggle with it, navigate it, and try to tell themselves they're doing something for the right reasons when they're actually not.
And it's a very Joel and Ethan Coenian way of looking at morality and at the slipperiness of morality and the slipperiness of the slopes that these people are on. It should be noted, Joel and Ethan Coen are executive producers of this.
Mm-hmm.
This project was brought to them by a guy named Noah Hawley, who has apparently written all 10 episodes himself. So this is very much the Coenian vision of a non-Coen person with the Coen brothers' stamp of approval on
it. The thing I love about the fact that this is a Noah Hawley project, I think this is so good. I think this is going to be considered a very, very, very high accomplishment in television.
Mm-hmm.
And the DNA here comes, not only did they not go get movie people like they did when it was like, oh, we're going to get David Fincher to make House of Cards.
Right.
And they didn't go get exclusively other prestige television people. There is DNA. Noah Hawley, I think, primarily in television comes from Bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that fact, because Bones is not dangerous, daring television. It's really well-executed network television. So the directing DNA on this show comes from people who have directed stuff like Revenge and The Good Wife and Psych and It's Always Sunny and, you know, a guy named Scott Winant who won an Emmy for directing 30-something. This is television DNA. And what I like about that is not to just have a world over here of prestige television people and then a world over here of regular television people or network television people, but the idea that that's a very porous boundary, even for a really ambitious project going to people who came up in television, not necessarily fancy pants television, but just solid television, like Bones and stuff like that.
It makes sense to me that that would be true, though, if you're dealing with a Coen Brothers movie, because the alternative is to try to outdo the Coen Brothers. Would want to try that?
I think that's right.
The visuals in this show are interesting. There is a little bit of Roger Deakins to them, but they're clearly TV. that was one of the things that put me off initially, and that I started liking more and more as it started to break bad, as it were.
Yeah.
So that it just became kind of
the exterior shooting does get lovelier. It's a little bleak in the beginning. I mean, it's shot in Calgary, and they're talking about how cold it is, and you can't see their breath, and it drives me crazy.
Well, right, and it's I did feel like, you know, especially the very beginning of Fargo, kind of the classic beginning of Fargo, the car rambling down the snowy street, and it's day, it's not night, but it's so whited out, and it's that kind of, you know, if you can say as like a kind of an oxymoron, it's that like white noir, right, that Fargo is. I felt like it's not quite as effective in the show as far as just looking at it and having a sense of how brutal that environment is. Mm. And I do think that the movie was considerably better at making me have that sense of like, God, I remember how effing cold it is when we're up there. The TV show is a little more mixed. I mean, there are a couple of specific references to ice fishing and some other things about that winter environment. But I did not feel like the visuals were quite as punishing as they are in the film.
What I like also is that the movie Fargo enters into this at weird angles. It evokes the movie in weird ways. Just it's like a mashup. It's like a variation on a theme. You get the word unguent kind of coming in and out in a really interesting way. The thing that the Coens are often criticized for, and Fargo was criticized for this too, is having a sort of condescension, feeling smarter than these characters, condescending to them. And the way that I always thought that Fargo didn't do that is because they took such time and trouble to show you that Marge Gunderson is a product of this place. Mm-hmm. She's not some proxy Hollywood intellectual coming in and solving everything. Right. She's not Flora Post from Cold Comfort Farm coming in and showing these rubes how to do it. It's very important that she comes from that place and that she is of that place. And I think that all of my concerns about tone, because I also thought in the beginning they were going really, really broad. And you don't necessarily notice that in the film because you have this, as you said, Bob, very specific performance from Frances McDormand that really just centers that film. And I was missing that for a while, but then, as you say, something happens. And all of my concerns about where we're focused, what the tone is, went away.
Yeah, and I think it should be noted, you mentioned Frances McDormand. I think Alison Tolman is terrific in the equivalent role on this show.
Yeah. One of the things I think works against the series a little bit is that in that first half an hour, you're looking for the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're looking for sort of she's the equivalent of her and he's the equivalent of him. And, well, actually, maybe this guy is more the Marge. And, you know, you're trying to orient yourself to the movie. And it's close enough that you can feel like you're doing it. I saw today, I was looking back at some of the coverage when this series was first announced, and there was really a sense that Martin Freeman is playing the William H. Macy character. And that's sort of true. It has that same feeling of kind of Midwestern pent-up rage, and they're playing some of the same notes, but it's not the same guy. And the Billy Bob Thornton character, who's kind of a guy who comes to town and is new to this town and new to these people, is really a unique invention of this show. Yeah. You know, he's not the Steve Buscemi. Right. He's a really different character. So if you watch it and you're looking for the movie, try to stick with it.
Yeah, trust me, you will find the movie, but you won't find it in quite the way you expected.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Did any of you find this show, this is a limited series, they're calling it. It's a 10-episode run. We have all seen 4. Did any of you feel, as I did, like you wished it was a Netflix original series so that you could just dump all 10 episodes in a row? Like now, episode 5 isn't going to air for like a month.
I know.
That is a problem.
I watched this and I want people to go ahead and watch it when it's on. I'm not in any way discouraging you from watching it when it's on, but this is also going to make a great, I think, binge watching show. Mm-hmm. I got to the end of the 4 and I was like, what? No! And that's a sign of a good show is when you get to the end of the ones you have and you just think, well, now I'm angry, you know, especially since it's very common for FX to send out entire seasons to critics. So get on it. He knows who he is. Send them to me, fella. All 10 straight to me. Mm. North Capitol Street. I accept mail. Yeah, I liked it. I liked it. Yeah, I was happy. It's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to adapt something great. So the other thing we were going to talk about today, this actually comes from our friend Tasha Robinson of The Dissolve. Incidentally, a great site. Please be reading it. They have been putting out some fantastic stuff recently. I think they have really completely hit their stride to the degree they ever had to. But anyway, Tasha Robinson, The Dissolve. Glenn, why don't you tell us what Tasha was talking about?
She was talking about encountering a piece of pop culture and not realizing that that piece of pop culture is riffing on an earlier piece of pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave us several examples. And that kind of led us to talking about what we're calling pop culture breadcrumbs, these things that lead you to something else, usually something earlier, but not always, I guess, that it owes a great debt to.
Yeah. And I will say before we start this conversation, last week I talked about that that series, The Story of Film, that I had been watching. And there's a lot of that in there where there were things that he explains. Oh, this shot is directly referencing this other shot from this classic movie that, of course, I haven't seen. And so there's a ton. As soon as you start researching film and researching television, you see them in the actual making of the thing. But I think she's talking more a little bit about references. How about you, Stephen? Have you ever seen such a thing happen in your life, I assume?
Yeah, I'm sure you can't even imagine where I'm going with this.
No.
But, you know, I have two children. I may have mentioned them on the show at some point in the past. They are 13 and 10. And I realized how much of their cultural DNA resides in things that are massively reference-based. The Simpsons, obviously. Futurama, obviously. And, you know, musically, for a while, they both went through lengthy Weird Al Yankovic phases. And all...
ironic children.
I thought you were going to say entirely cool kids. I'm kind of raising, like, two little Fonzies.
Yep.
But I've been amazed at how informed they seem to be when they encounter a lot of these references, at least in terms of knowing what they are. You know, everything from your Soylent Green to your, you know, any number of Star Wars references to whatever. We were watching King of the Nerds, as Glenn has recommended on this show, and you know, King of the Nerds has a lot of geeks talking about geek things, and I was amazed at, like, my son's knowledge of Star Trek, which we don't sit around watching. We've never sat around watching Star Trek. But through Futurama in particular, he's absorbed all of this Star Trek knowledge. And I think that more and more in this everything that ever was available forever world that we're in, these references, you want to have seen the thing, you know, in part because these things are so prevalent, in part because they have value. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to deny your kids the cultural education of having seen these things.
Yeah.
But they're so familiar with so many of these things because of those three entities, The Simpsons, Futurama, Weird Al Yankovic. One other Simpsons note I should make. I was talking to a coworker of mine, Daoud Tyler Amin, and he had asked me a question, and I kind of went, yes? I mean, I wasn't even trying to do it. It just kind of was just being a dork. And he just goes, oh, from The Simpsons. And because they have a guy who, when addressed, he would go, yes, and then would do the verse, it's because he's doing Frank Nelson.
Right.
Particularly, I feel, from The Jack Benny Show, which, I mean, I'm sure Frank Nelson did that shtick in other contexts. But I knew that character because when I was a kid, I was immersed
in... Stephen Thompson getting the Jack Benny reference.
I was obsessed with Jack Benny shows through much of my childhood. And I was like, but it's Frank... No, it's Frank Nelson. And kids now, and Daoud, of course, is like 30,
right,
is like, oh, it's The Simpsons.
Yep.
Right.
Insolent whelp.
The terrifying thing about this is all my references are from 100 years ago. So that I remember seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey ages ago and watching that shot at the beginning where you're on the moon, you're looking at the Earth rising, and beyond that, the sun is rising, right? So it's beautifully lined up shot of orbs. And then years later, seeing Paths of Glory, which Kubrick made much earlier, but there's a shot in it where there are several trenches. This is World War One, and a helmet comes up out of a trench right close to you. Another one comes out, and they're all in this perfect line. Mm-hmm. It is the same shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, my God, he was doing this. No one noticed that at the time.
Right.
And I was like, ah. Now, I have a different experience that happens to me all the time. My husband is from Argentina. His reference point for all things United Statesian are different than mine. The first time he heard the Three Stooges, they had Spanish voices.
Yeah.
He doesn't think that it sounds right here. And so when something as basic as 9/11 happens, right, the falling of the towers and all that, everyone else was saying, well, this has to be Al-Qaeda. You know, we were hearing all of that. And his reaction was, no, this is the anniversary of the coup in Chile.
Oh, my God.
Of the assassination.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's what this is.
That
it was clearly that. And I thought, but, you know, we see the world very differently. It was just sort of fascinating.
Yeah. I think it's very easy to not know how steeped you are in the world that you grew up in. And this obviously becomes something that has enormous intersections with race and class and gender and stuff like that. Because what you think of as important from culture and what references echo for you doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what echoes for anybody else.
Right. And speaking of important, if you spent any time at homesick watching cartoons in the middle of the afternoon, you have heard and seen this.
What a cute little pink bunny rabbit. Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny.
So that's
rabbit.
Looney Tunes, of course, The Abominable Snow Rabbit, starring Mel Blanc as the voice of the Abominable Snowman. Mel Blanc, who voiced all the Looney Tunes, also used that exact same voice when somebody got hit on the head with an anvil, and he would proceed to say, "Which way did he go, George? Which way did he go?" Both of those performances are based not only on the character of Lenny in Of Mice and Men, but on a very specific performance by Lon Chaney Jr. of the character Lenny in the 1939 film Of Mice and Men.
George.
What do you want?
Where are we going?
Forgot that already, did you?
Oh, I forgot. I tried not to forget. Honest, I did.
Okay, I'll tell you again. I got nothing else to do. Might as well spend my time telling you things. You forget them and I'll tell you again.
I tried, but it didn't do no good. I remember about the rabbits, George.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
I did not know that
until
right now.
I didn't know that
now.
Either.
Yeah.
That's really
interesting. You just made me smarter.
And in fact, if you go back to any Looney Tunes, especially in the 40s and 50s, they are doing nothing but riffing on pop culture.
Must have been a beautiful baby.
Exactly. There are so many. There are
some of which is like incredibly racist.
True that. But also there's all this Hollywood references and caricatures of Hollywood actors appearing.
Oh, yeah.
In Hollywood Steps Out from 1941, Slick Hair from 47, Hollywood Daffy also from 47, have all these. When I was a six-year-old kid, I was seeing all kinds of Betty Davis jokes.
And Jimmy Cagney
and
cartoons.
Jimmy Cagney.
And
there is in Hollywood Steps Out, a Ray Milland Lost Weekend joke.
Well, of course there is.
In Lost Weekend, Ray Milland plays an alcoholic writer, so he basically goes in, pays at the bar with a giant typewriter, puts it on the bar, and gets in change four smaller typewriters. Always thought it was funny, had no idea what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
But so I always thought of Looney Tunes as the Pixar, but it turns out they were closer to the DreamWorks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. One of the things I think is really funny, and Stephen and I have talked about this before, is that Stephen and I both grew up listening to a lot of Tom Lehrer.
Yeah.
And Tom Lehrer was doing, around the time of the Vietnam War and earlier, was doing, you know, all kinds of political, incredibly topical comedy. And Stephen and I, both as kids, just lapped it up.
Yep.
And it's been like, it was like a 30-year process figuring out what the hell he was talking about. Because you get it at one level. You know, you can understand, for example, New Math, right?
Right.
Which is a whole little thing he does about when they were trying to get kids to learn new math, quote unquote.
But in the new approach, as you know, the important thing is to understand what you're doing rather than to get the right answer. Here's how they do it now. You can't take 3 from 2. 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the tens place. Now that's really 4 tens, so you make it 3 tens, regroup, and you change a 10 to 10 ones, and you add to the 2 and get 12, and you take away 3, that's 9. Is that clear?
But it's not until much later that you sort of learn where that fits into parental anxiety about...
It's so simple that only a child can do it.
About fads in education and things like that. And that's not even too... begin to get into the dirty jokes that, of course, I did not get. The he went to school and majored in animal husbandry until they caught him at it. It's who got? I mean, I was listening to this stuff when I was 8, and you don't get them until later. And in terms of references, I was thinking about the fact that when I was, I don't know, however old I would have been when it came out, I was a slavish devotee of Robin Williams Live at the Met. Which was when Robin Williams was sort of at the height of his stand-up career and his kind of manic stand-up. There are a ton of jokes, and of course he's doing voices all the time. It's like Aladdin on a stage.
but better.
But better. And you don't figure out until later necessarily what all of those voices were and what all those quotes from movies come from.
Right.
But it doesn't really matter because it's, as you were saying with your kids at The Simpsons, you don't sit there the whole time thinking, well, I don't know what that is. That doesn't make sense to me. You just hear the joke. The joke is funny. You laugh. You pretend to get it because that's what you
think. Or you think they created it out of whole
cloth. Or you think they created it out of whole cloth. And you think that him doing that voice is just funny. And then you don't learn it's a classic line from a movie until 20 years later. Yeah. And who cares?
This is kind of a definition of camp, isn't it? It's the whole thing.
Everything in quotation marks.
Right. That everything's in quotation marks. And I'm thinking it also reminds me of the thing that used to happen when we were in high school, and they would tell us about the jokes that Shakespeare was making that don't make any sense 400 years later, but that at the time, you know, the audiences would have understood this as that. And that's kind of what we're talking about, but it's only 20 years, right? Or 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, Mystery Science Theater 3000 basically throws out so many references to other things that sometimes you can pick it up and follow it and follow that breadcrumb down to actually what it's from, and sometimes it just passes by.
Airplane's the same way.
Exactly.
There's so much going on, foreground, background. You know, you're not getting all the jokes because nobody would get all the jokes.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned this before, but, you know, you have your very religious Aunt Marion who for most of your childhood gives you socks or a devotional Bible. And then one year in fifth grade, she gives you this awesome collection of books called The Chronicles of Narnia. And you're like, yeah, I mean, there's no wizards, there's no map. But like all of a sudden, like, way to go. And and it took me three books. I was not smart because it is not subtle. But I just remember the feeling of, what?
Yeah.
What?
It was God all along.
Yeah, it was such an overt Christ allegory that basically, like, you could just imagine the lion just kind of holding up a paw going, ah? See the hole? Get it?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Well, I think that was a very, very good suggestion from Tasha.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tasha, as always. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
So much blatant pandering to what NPR does.
Nice.
But first of all, congratulations due to Michelle Norris and Walter Ray Watson winning a Peabody Award for the Race Card Project.
Absolutely.
Congratulations to Morning Edition's Borderland series for winning a Peabody Award next year.
And being awesome.
And being so incredibly awesome. If you have not heard/seen it, it's just...
It's some reporting that Stevens Keep, along with some other people, including our friend Kana Azamaria, did in on the border.
Yeah, they followed the border between the U.S. and Mexico and telling stories along the way. It's it's incredible
it's
work.
It's wonderful. We will link to it.
A much more minor piece of NPR work that I really enjoyed was, I usually hate everything associated with April Fool's Day.
You do.
It is. I'm on record as detesting April Fool's Day. It is... Yeah. Much the way that the vampires on Buffy the Vampire Slayer hated Halloween.
Yes.
On the NPR Facebook page, they posted a story a link called Why Doesn't America Read Anymore? And it was an experiment in how many Facebook comments would be left before somebody clicked through and saw that that they were just being trolled.
Yeah, that it wasn't a real story. Mm-hmm. It just said, if you actually clicked through, it said, we're just seeing.
And it was
people actually read this.
And it was dozens upon dozens of just outrage. Yeah. First of all, I do read. So that was...
Not this.
Not this, it turns out. So clever, actually an effective use of April Fool's Day. Anyway, I can't believe I'm saying that April Fool's Day made me happy. But
wonderful. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week,
Well,
sir?
Proving that I'm much older than Stephen. I am obsessing lately over 1620, the year 1620.
You're not that much older than me.
Because in 1620, these colonists came over to the United States, to what was then...
Right.
This place over here, and arrived in Virginia and discovered that barley wouldn't grow. All of the barley plants wilted, and so they couldn't make beer. Mm-hmm. And it would take years to grow grapes to the point that they could actually make wine, and they had no booze. And it drove them crazy. And then someone discovered corn. And I have a quote here from the someone. It is from December 19, 1620. George Thorpe wrote, "We have found a way to make so good drink of Indian corn. I have divers times refused to drink good, strong English beer and chose to drink that." That is the moment that bourbon was born. And I know this because of a book called A History of the American Spirit, Bourbon.
Oh, nice.
By Dane Hucklebridge that mm-hmm. is coming out in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I am having so much fun reading this book. Bourbon is my favorite drink by so many miles. And this is, it just makes me very happy.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Bob Mondello.
My pleasure.
I enjoy bourbon also. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. Now is not the time for the David Letterman and Comiums. That time is coming. It's a year away when he actually retires.
Right.
But I would want to urge anybody who will be writing one of those to follow our own Linda Holmes' lead. And when you talk about David Letterman's legacy, you must talk about Meryl Marco.
Yes.
You don't get David Letterman without Meryl Marco. She was his head writer. And when the time for the encomiums will come, I am going to talk a long time about the David Letterman show, this daytime television show he had for 5 months in 1980, where everything that is David Letterman, I was going to say today, everything that is Letterman in the 80s and 90s got formed by that combination, that collaboration between uh-huh. Meryl Marco and David Letterman. If you want to start doing some research on that, a good place to start is on Julie Klausner's podcast, How Was Your Week? A long interview with Meryl Marco just came out this week as we type. It's really good. It's fascinating, and she is great. That's one thing.
And in fairness, I will add, I included Meryl Marco partly because someone on Twitter reminded me. Someone on Twitter said, let's not forget. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, I'm really glad that that person mentioned that, because that is so very, very true.
She came up with Stupid Patrick. So much. Anyway.
Yeah.
The other thing, Stephen, is that I, for the first time ever, am DVRing ESPN Classic. Why am I doing that, you ask? Because of the battle. The Network Stars, which was, one of the first reality competition shows. Went from 1976 to 1984, twice a year. It's exactly what it sounds like. Now, this is going to mean
celebrity
nothing.
Celebrity rehab?
when they're healthy.
It's the precursor. It's the precursor. Celebrity rehab.
It's going to sound like nothing to you tots out there who don't know. But if you know mm-hmm. the shows that were on television between 1976 and 1984, and you will just, it's exactly what it says. The different, each of the three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, chose 8 celebrities from different shows to come together and compete at things like a relay race and a dunk tank and a tug of war. And it's just the stupidest thing. Now, ESPN is collapsing 120 minutes down to an hour. Mm. So the people at ESPN have the benighted opinion that the actual competition matters, when I want everything else.
More Gabe Kaplan. Hang those who talk of less.
More Gabe Kaplan in a headband. More Robert Conrad. Just like the vein in his head starts to throb as soon as he gets on camera. He is just an angry hockey dad throughout the entire thing. They care so much about this stupid competition. And so what you want is early, 77, 76, when it took place on the grounds of Pepperdine University. In the 80s, you got... They moved it to Mexico for some reason because, I guess, of our strict regulations against celebrity kayaking. To get around that, I don't exactly know what the hell that was about. But it's got something for everybody. Some of us will like Charlene Tilton in a dunk tank. Others will enjoy Greg Harrison in a Speedo. Mm-hmm. It's got everything you need. It's got Howard Cosell being an equal opportunity creep. Going up, she stands before me, resplendent, stalwart. The body... magnificent. Miss Kathy Lee Crosby. And later he says, I like this Selleck kid. Long, lean, and look at the power in those arms. A true athlete. Now, you want to have a drink every time anybody on this show says the words, a true athlete. And you will not last. The Battle of the Network Stars on ESPN yes. Classic. It makes me so happy.
We need to restart this. I want to see, Jim Parsons running in a relay race.
With Juliana Margulies.
Against Juliana Margulies. That is a winning idea right there, Stephen Thompson. So what is making me happy this week? HBO debuted its new series, Silicon Valley, which comes from Mike Judge, mm-hmm. who made Beavis and Butthead and Daria and Office Space and lots of other great stuff. And Silicon Valley involves these dudes who all live in this one of these tech incubators. And one of them comes up with an idea that he sort of doesn't understand the full power of. But once the full power of it becomes clear, he essentially, the opening conflict is he has two giant offers on the table. One is the guy who wants to just buy it from him and own it. That's the guy from Hooli, which is their Google. Mm-hmm. Then there's another eccentric weirdo who doesn't want to buy it. He just wants to invest and let the guy keep it and build it himself and have it be his company. So that's his opening dilemma. And once he makes that choice, he is then working with his friends. And the friends that he's working with who are in this little incubator are, they are stereotypical geeks in a way, but in a funny way. There's some extremely incisive, funny stuff about race and racism in Silicon Valley. And I think they do a good job not making it an unending stream of tech nerd jokes. Mm-hmm. And it's, what I like about this show is that it is satire, and a lot of people have written about it as satire and how effective it is as satire. But it's also just full of good jokes. And I am not always a Mike Judge person. I was not necessarily a Beavis and Butthead person. This, I sat down and I watched the first five, and they were very entertaining, and I enjoyed it a lot. And it's a terrific cast. There's a bunch of really funny dudes. And it's not the kind of thing I would normally necessarily think I was the target audience for, but I wound up really, really enjoying it. Silicon Valley, HBO. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Bob at Bob at _ Montbello. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. And of course, you can follow our dear pal, Trey Graham, at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, and Graham like the cracker, and I'm sure that he will keep you updated on German art song, as well as his travels to rainbows and theater and all else that lies ahead. And you can follow our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. You can follow our also producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica _Reedy, R-E-E-D-Y. And, of course, our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thank you to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, imagine you could call up a friend and say, meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy. Now, imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now, stop imagining and subscribe to the Planet Money podcast. Find Planet Money on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts.